Well, yesterday I got an opportunity to go to arguably one of the best theology classes that I've ever been to. It was yesterday morning, and it's an eight-week session. And so I actually wanted to go to it first before I came here and said, you all should attend. It's in Mission Viejo, Saturday morning. It's free. There's tons of Compass families that already go there. And I didn't know anything about it. But when I checked it out, it was almost life-changing, seriously. And so I get there, and even Pastor Mark was there, and I'm like, why didn't you tell me about this? Why did I have to find out? But so Pastor Mark was there, and what was interesting about that is the coordinator decided to put us head-to-head to compete about theological things. And I'm not ashamed to say he won, right? You know what? He won. He can have this one, but I'm sure we'll get a rematch here in these next 8 weeks. But it told me everything that I needed to know, especially about Genesis. I mean, that was arguably one of the best studies and sessions that I had in preparation for this message, and it came yesterday morning. So it was great, and I do want to recommend that you attend if you get the opportunity to. Saturday morning free in Mission Viejo. And I actually was able to take some pictures because it was just, again, it was great. When you think about God's just relationship with us as humanity and how we respond when God gives us commands and we do what we want to do, it put it right front and center and allowed me to see it very clearly. And I actually took a few pictures for you all to see. That way it can probably entice you to go next Saturday and for the next 8 weeks, because there's a lot of sessions that are happening. So here was the setting here. And if you don't recognize it, it was my wonderful daughter Blake's four-year-old soccer game. And yes, we played against Pastor Mark's son Aaron, and they won. But what was interesting about this is it was the exact image of humanity, us thinking, I want to do what I want to do, versus here are the rules, here are the commands, here's what you're supposed to do. And it was hilarious. I mean, you got kids on the sideline. They're supposed to be in the game. They're on the sideline eating tortillas in the morning because parents just want to make their kids happy, and so they're feeding them tortillas on the sideline. You got other kids that are screaming and crying the second that the other team scores a goal. They don't like it. They're jealous. They're envious. So they're screaming and crying when they don't get their way. You got other kids that, yes, it's soccer. It is football. Football overseas is what they call it, football. You kick the ball, but kids are like, I don't understand why you just don't pick it up and throw it in a goal. Seems logical to me. Why can't we just do that? So they want to create their own rules, right? They want to rebel against the game. My daughter didn't do that. But I'll pick on my daughter a little bit, too. As you can see, being my child, she's a big four-year-old. And she was the Jolly Green Giant out there amongst these other kids. And so what she would do is, instead of going to kick the ball into the goal, she would get in this huge scrum, and she'd put the ball between her legs, and she'd stand there. And I just saw, again, another example of us, like the fear of man. Because these little kids are like, ref, what are we supposed to do? I'm not going to take the ball from her. She's huge. I'm not going to do that. So I saw this teaching, and it's like, here's the fear of man. You got somebody who's standing here and commanding, this is how I want to run it. This is how things should go. And we all just back away and say, well, I guess so. I don't want to suffer the consequences or the wrath of that little girl. So they didn't do anything. And then you have, even in the midst of all of that, the referee. And here's where I want to dial in, because again, the referee is responsible for keeping the game going, right? Regardless of what the kids might think, regardless of what the parents might think, regardless of what the coach might say, the referee is the one that calls the shots, right? And so the coach might say, kick it in the goal, and the referee says, stop play, we stop play. It doesn't matter what your coach just said. So here's the referee, and I'm looking at him, and not that this referee is God by any means, but he gets to call the shots of what's going on. And so if a kid wants to pick up the ball, the referee says, stop, that's not how the game is played. You are to kick the ball. If the kid wants to cry and scream every time the other team gets a goal, the referee says, play on. Because you're envious and because you're jealous, I'm not stopping the game for you. We're going to continue to play. And so when you think about our relationship with God, and again, I'm being facetious with it, but honestly, looking at this soccer game, it just reminded me of us in our relationship with God, because we're so busy doing what we want to do, what we feel like is right, what makes sense to us, but God, the referee of this entire creation, is saying, you have to abide by my rules. Otherwise, you either go sit out or the game will move on without you. And so it teaches a lot, but it teaches a lot about Genesis, because Genesis, God gives us creation, and he gives us exact communication on what needs to happen for this creation. And he's clear on it, right? But all too often we say, well, I want to be God. And what we have to realize is we make lousy gods because we're not God. And we see that all throughout the story of Genesis, all the way to what's happening today in the world, is when people want to say, well, I want to make a name for myself. Well, if I were God, I would do it this way. And at the end of the day, God's the referee, and he's the one that gets to call the shots in the end. So Genesis is the book that sets the stage for the rest of the Bible. If you don't have a good understanding of Genesis, if you don't have a good understanding of God's creation and his relationship with humanity, you'll miss the rest of the Bible. And so that's why it's important for us to get a firm understanding. And yeah, normally we'd like to jump in front of the book and give that prep as you get ready to read it in the DBR. But it was so critical that we spent time talking about Genesis to make sure we get that right before we get to the rest of the books throughout the remainder of the year. And so we're going to talk about Genesis this morning. And again, as you know already, there's a lot going on in Genesis. There's a lot of debate about Genesis, a lot that we won't be able to get to. But what I want to be able to pull out today is the most important things that we need to know about the book of Genesis. And hopefully this is a good review for you as you've read through all the way up to chapter 38 today as we started. You've read through, you can look back and say, yep, I remember that. Or, Lord willing, you can say, oh, I didn't realize that, but that's good that I have this connection now because it's going to help me understand as I continue to read even through the remainder of Genesis. So let's talk about what we're going to go through today. And here's the breakdown that we have. First of all, we're going to talk about what Genesis teaches us. So there's a handful of things, and there's way more than I'm even going to provide you today, but I want to provide you with a lot of things that we can know that Genesis is going to teach us as we read it. And it's going to set the stage. It's going to help us understand more of what's happening today and why things are the way that they are today and what's God's redemptive plan for all humanity. And then we're going to get into controversial issues. And again, I'll tell you right now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I wish I had time. Some of these issues take years and years and years to even get a good understanding of that. So I'll give you some of the main controversial issues that there are out there. Maybe later on we can have specific times where we go back and study exactly what this is or what they are and why they are controversies. And then we're going to get into a few key themes. I want to get you set on the understanding of what Genesis is all about. What are the themes that we can take away? Again, way more than I'm going to give you that's there, but we'll give you some to take home and to continue to study through the book of Genesis. And then, as normally, we'll go through the book structure and overview. So we'll do a quick flyover over all 50 chapters of Genesis and then give you some key takeaways, all in a matter of 35 minutes now. So, all right, hopefully that soccer illustration did something for you because that took some time. All right, so let's get into what Genesis teaches us. And I alluded to this earlier, but one of the first things I want you to realize is, look, God's the boss, and he's very clear in his communication. No matter what the world tries to say today, no matter what culture tries to say, well, God didn't mean it that way. He's very clear in his communication on what he wants to have happen with creation and what his promises are and what we are to do and what our responsibility is. He's very clear on that, right? And it's not him that's the problem. It's not him that creates all these issues in the world. It's us. God's perfect. God is holy. God has a plan that is perfect. And we are the ones that create the problems. And we'll see that quite quick. We'll see that quickly as we read through the creation story. I mentioned this just a minute ago, but it teaches us how to understand the rest of the Bible. Again, if you don't have a firm grasp of Genesis, you miss most of the remainder of Scripture because it starts in Genesis, right? You think about a race, like a track race, right? If you false start, if you have a miss at the start of it, you're disqualified, right? You don't have, you can't understand the rest of it. You can't comprehend it, right? And so it's vital that we have a right start, an appropriate start to understand everything else that's going to happen for the remainder of the 65 books of the Bible. It tells us everything about sin and evil. Everything. Everything we need to know. Right? Does it give you every little minor detail? No, but it tells us in general sense everything we need to know about sin and evil. So when people ask you that day-old question of, well, why does it have to happen? Why is evil? Go back to Genesis. Right? Why is there so much? Go back to Genesis. Just go back to Genesis and just read through and understand the stories that God gives us to remind us that, look, it's not him, it's us when we try to be God. Right? We get the development of languages. Languages all over the globe, right? How do those come about, right? We'll talk about that and understand how that all got started. Genesis teaches us that God's plan will not be thwarted. It won't be. It's not possible. God has a plan. It's a perfect plan. We tend to mess it up, but no matter how much we think we're messing it up, we're not messing up God's plan. It's continuing to happen all the way until the end of time, right? And so we can have confidence in his plan is how I put it there. And then we see God's divine election. Very clear here, and I'll try to make it as clear as I can once we get to that point, but we don't deserve anything. You and I don't deserve anything, and we don't even deserve this covenant. And I'll show you why, but it's because of God's grace. It's being shown here clearly in Genesis. We think about God's grace and mercy in the New Testament, but it's here in Genesis is where it starts, and we see the first instance of his grace. And then his mercy. God keeps his promises in spite of what we do, right? Humanity is wicked at heart, right? If we're left to our own devices, we're just as bad as everybody that is mentioned in Genesis. But God, right? Ephesians 2 tells, but God. And he's merciful, right? He's gracious. And in spite of everything that we do, he continues to use us for his glory, not for ours. So one of the main things that I want you to pull out of Genesis, and I broke this down for you, is I want you to see the theme. How many bad choices there are by men. Man, all right? God sets us up. Here's the plan. We make horrible decisions. Because we want things our way. We want things the way it makes sense to us, that we think it's right. But again, we're not God. We make lousy gods. And so as we go into this next slide, this will be helpful once you get this, once you see the printout, because it's really cool when you put it side by side. And this is the bad choices by man. And I have them all listed out here. Right? Chapter 3, we look at Eve. She disobeys God. She listens to the serpent. Did God really say you can't? How much does that happen in today? Does the Bible really say that? And so it even happens today still. The Bible doesn't really say. God was really trying to say this. No, God was very clear, right? And then we get into chapter 4. Cain murders Abel, right? God wasn't pleased. He wasn't mad about his offering, but he just didn't show as much joy as he did for Abel. Cain got jealous. And God gave him an opportunity. He says, sin is crouching at your door, Cain. Look, repent. Don't give in to it. But what does Cain do? He's still mad. He's still envious. He kills his brother. All right, he makes the decision that I want things my way. This is payback. Right? Cain kills Abel. Babel, let us make a name for ourselves. Right? God says, disperse, spread amongst the earth, be fruitful and multiply. But then everybody gets together and say, why should we do that? Let us make a name for ourselves. Let us be God. Let's get together, build this thing up, because we want to be God. We don't want to spread out. That's going to be hard, like a church plant, right? Let's just build a mega church here and have fun here. No, let's go spread the gospel. Let's get out. Let's spread, right? Let us make a name for ourselves. Bad decision. Abraham and Sarah, right? They lie to Pharaoh. God's going to protect them. God makes his promise that he's going to protect them, and he lies. This is my sister, because I'm trying to protect myself. Not worried about her, what can happen to her, but I got to protect me. I care about me, Abraham says. So lies to Pharaoh. Sarah and Hagar. Sarah's frustrated. I can't have offspring. Get my servant in here. Have offspring with her. And immediately she gets upset, right? Immediately. Right? She's resentful. 17 and 18. Sarah and Abraham laugh at God. 17. Abraham laughs. I'm old. You want me to have, I'm old. Okay, I'll show you. Sarah. She laughs at God. Sarah, you laughed at me. No, I didn't know. Yeah, you did laugh. Matter of fact, I'm going to make you name your son Laughter, right? Isaac. So you laugh at God. Bad choice. Probably shouldn't laugh and mock God. I don't know. I mean, it seems wise to me. Chapter 19, Lot and his family. God urges them. He's telling them, get out of there. I'm about to destroy this place. And what does it say? It says Lot lingers, right? The rest of his family doesn't take him serious. Come on now. God's not going to do that. So he lingers. And God shows him mercy and pulls him out of there, right? Gets him out of there so he destroys all of Sodom and Gomorrah. But he lingers. He doesn't take it seriously. Again, think about today, right? God is going to come back at any point in time. I got time, right? Ain't not going to come back today. Maybe I'll get to it tomorrow. I'll get to it next week, right? We tend to linger. That still happens today. Chapter 20, Abraham lies about Sarah. Again, he gets to Abimelech. Same thing. He fears, and he's willing to give up his wife. I don't. This is my sister. You can have her, take her, but God has to step in. Bad choices. We got more. Isaac lies about Rebekah. Same thing. Lies to Abimelech. Right. Same. We don't know if it's the same Abimelech or is that just a throne name. Not sure, but same situation in Gerar. He lies. Says, this is my sister. Same thing dad does. Jacob deceives Isaac for a blessing. Knows he shouldn't do it. He lies to his dad. Are you sure? You sure you're Esau? Yeah, I'm Esau. You see the hairy hands, right? You smell me. I'm Esau. His mom even gets involved with it. Bad choices by men. Rachel, same thing. She can't have offspring. I don't know. My servant, here, have offspring with her. Gets mad right away. Bad choices. Simon, Levi. Their sister gets raped, and they destroy the entire city. Right? They're back in Canaan. They destroy the entire city because they want to avenge their sister. Right? They almost threaten the blessing because they take out Canaan, or city areas in Canaan where they are called to reside. But God steps in and helps them. Reuben lays with his father's concubine. He doesn't get mad right away, but later on when he's talking about the promises, he brings it back up. Bad decision. Joseph sold into slavery by his brothers. They were jealous of him. Jealous that father loved him. Jealous that he's rubbing it in their face. We're going to sell him into slavery. Bad decision. God makes it better. Judah sleeps with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. Interesting story to read today. We'll break that down just because when you read it, you're like, well, where did this come from? Why are we talking about this? We'll make sense of it, of why that has to be there. But again, bad decision. Judah makes a bad decision. Sleeps with who he thinks is a prostitute. Not a good thing. But then when you go into it, you see, regardless of all those bad decisions, man continues to make over and over and over again. God at any point in time has the right to say, I'm done with this. Done. And he would still be a faithful, he'd still be a holy God because he's just doing what he should do and he should wipe us all away. But God keeps his promises. And what's interesting about these, and I won't go through all of them individually, is if you look at it, the alignment of, if you put these side by side, every time a bad decision is made, almost every time, God comes back and gives his promise, right? Every time that Abraham lies and says, hey, this is my sister, God says, hey, I'm protecting you. I got you, okay? Every time that they say, well, I can't have offspring, I'm going to give you offspring. I got you. I know what I'm doing, right? So he gives these promises. He continues to keep his promise all the way through. Through Abraham, through Jacob, through Isaac, keeps his promise and reminds them time after time after time again, I got this. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to bless you. Continue to follow my path. But of course, we don't. So keep that in mind as we go through and read the story of Genesis, even as you read it yourself. Think how many times man has made bad decisions, but God is like, I'm here. I'm going to take care of you. Controversial issues. Here, I'm just going to list them, but like I said, we just don't have time to even scratch the surface on any of these. Creation versus evolution. It's there. right? Simple answer as Christians, God created heavens and earth. Genesis 1:1. That's it, right? We don't need to make it overly complicated, but it's a big issue, right? I'm making small of it, but it's a simple answer as we can read scripture and read what God says and take it literally. He created it. Same thing, old earth, young earth. I'll give you a simple answer, young earth, right? God says day, yom, 24-hour period. God is capable of doing that. He doesn't need more time. God can call into order whatever he wants to, however time frame he wants to call it. 24-hour day periods, right? So we look at a young earth, not billions and billions and billions of years in between, not a gap theory, right, that's in between the time that's happening. Right, our chapters 1 through 11, just a myth, right? We can't find them on the map necessarily. We don't know where the garden is. We don't know. We don't have evidence of where the flood happened. Did it wipe away? Did it flood the entire earth? Did it flood just that area? You know, we don't know for sure. We can't scientifically find things. They've found a few things, but it's not just obvious. But no, God's word says it happened, so it happened, right? It's not a myth. It sets up everything moving forward, regardless of if we can find it on a map today or not. Did Moses write Genesis? Yes, he did. Yeah, he did. And again, I'm making light of the situation. There's a ton of study on it, and there's even scholarly people that have good arguments. Did he really write it? The main thing is, again, Moses is not in Genesis, so to think he can go back and give exactly what happened from creation all the way down to Joseph's time in Egypt and even what's being said, that's the big question. It just doesn't make sense logically. But again, we're talking about a God. Talking about a God that can speak through his spirit, through Moses, and put pen to paper and write exactly out how it was created. And so, again, big controversy there, but yeah. Let's keep moving. Key themes there. Key themes here. Three. Generation. God created everything. Right? God created everything. He generated. He started it up. He created everything. Man is rebellious. Man is rebellious. So degeneration. God created it, and then because man is rebellious, it causes things to fall. Regeneration. God has a new plan. He regenerates things for the rest of time. And this plan will go to the end, his redemptive plan, regeneration. So generation, degeneration, regeneration is how I want you to think of the key themes. And again, there's a lot of themes throughout Genesis. Probably give you 50 of them, but I want to simplify it as much as we can. As we look at the structure, there's many ways to structure Genesis. And one of the main ways, I don't know if you've heard about it, is Toldoth. Toldoth. Toldoth is the way that many people, it's the most popular way to structure Genesis. And what Toldoth is basically, it means these are the generations of. So if you look at a lot of the genealogies that are broken down in the book of Genesis, they link to one another, right? These are the generations of Noah. These are the generations of Esau. These are the generations of Terah. And so you keep going through and you notice all the people. And a lot of the times, it may not be talking about the person that the genealogy is about, the Toldoth is about, but what's happening beyond that, right? And so if you look on here, Abraham, probably can't see it that clearly, but Abraham doesn't have a Toldoth. Like, it's not Toldoth of Abraham, right? But his whole explanation is in that subcategory A, Terah. So he's a descendant of Terah, and then you get the whole Abraham story, right? And so it's not about Terah. That's just the link. That's just the actual structure of it, and then you get everybody else underneath it. So you see the genealogies that are listed, and they all start with these are the generations of, which is the cool part. So if you read that, Toldoth is the most popular structural form that we have out there. And again, it serves as a linking device. The other one is geographical, and I put these on your table because I'll reference this, but this is a great way to study Genesis, is to find out how far they're traveling. Where are we at? What are we talking about? And so you can look at it from a geographical standpoint. And you look and see chapters 1 through 3, we're in Eden, right? We're in the garden. And we're talking about Adam and Eve. We're talking about the fall, what's happening there. And then they get booted out of the garden, right? And they go east of the garden. And so chapters 4 to 6 is east of Eden. And then you go on to 7 and 9. You have, we're on the ark, right? And then you're on, and they're in the mountains of Ararat when the ark is set upon the mountains there. So you have the ark in Ararat there in chapter 7 through 9. And then we're in Babel, or Babylon, in chapters 10 through 11, is where that area. And then from 12 to 36, our largest chunk of time is Abraham coming from Ur, making his way through Ur up to Haran, and then down through Canaan, and he continues to sojourn all the way through, close to Egypt, back over, all the way up to Haran, and all the way through. So it's good to look at that and have an understanding of where they are and even the names behind some of those. And then, of course, 37 through 50, we got Joseph and him moving the rest of the family to Egypt. But the structure that we're going to take is a little bit of the geographical approach, but we're going to take the structure of the primeval history versus primeval history and then the patriarchal history, right? And so primeval is before the time of the patriarchs, right? And so as it said, Genesis 1 through 11, before we get into the patriarchal period, which is Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. I put Joseph in there. He's not one of the original patriarchs, but most of the story is about Joseph and his time in Egypt, so we give him his own category too as well. But you'll see the breakdown of that, and I have a gap in the middle. You're probably like, did you forget to align your bubbles close enough to one another? No, I didn't forget that, but I want to talk about a huge, significant this time and even command from God that, again, sets the stage for everything else to come and sets the stage even for us today to have an opportunity to be part of God's family. And that's the covenant, God's covenant with Abraham, where he talks about he's going to protect him. He's going to have presence there. He's going to promise him a land, offspring, and blessing to all nations, right? And so it starts in 12 verses 1 through 3, but then it is repeated throughout Abraham's time during his chapters 12 through 23, multiple times, repeated again. Here's the promise that I'm giving you. Here's a promise that I'm giving you over and over again. So let's start with the primeval history and then do our flyover there. And the first thing is creation. So we got creation, and of course, God creates heavens and the earth, and he creates everything in 6 days, right? And so we get the atmosphere in the sky, day two, trees, dry plants, and then sun, moon, stars. There we get our seasons, and the time is happening now on day four. Day five, birds and sea creatures that we get, and then, of course, day six, we get land animals, and then man and woman. And what's important about this, again, it's simple for us, but important for us to remember, especially in our culture and our day and age, going back to Scripture and what did God say, verse 26 and 27. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over fish and over the seas and over the birds and the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male, female, binary, other, no. No. Not that. Male, female, he created them. Period, end of story, right? We're not adding things to what God should have done, or did he forget? No, male and female. So that would clear up so much if we just got that right, in our culture. A lot of things, right? So, but unfortunately we don't, and we're called to speak the truth and remember these passages. Then we get into the fall, right? God set it up. He said, it is good. Everything is good. Not good, average, okay, good, as imperfect in God's language. And then, of course, we get the serpent that comes, and he tempts. Genesis 3:1. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast in the field, and the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God actually say, remember I alluded to that earlier, did he really say that? Right? Did your parents really tell you couldn't stay out past 10 o'clock? What about 10:05? They're not going to really get mad at you if you do. Yeah, they will. Because they said 10 o'clock, right? God said, don't eat from the tree. But they did it anyway. What happens right after? Bad choices. Immediately, the guilty happens. Guilty action is hiding, right? He's ashamed. He's hiding. They're covering up. Like, what just happened? Now I need to cover up. I'm in fear. Why'd you hide from me? Because I was afraid. Now there's fear being brought into it. Adam, why did you do this? Don't blame me. Blame the woman. You gave her to me. Like, now all of a sudden, it's not my fault. It's her fault, right? Blame. Guilty actions enter. Then we get, again, all of this is proto-evangelium, right? It's a fancy word, but it's basically taking two Greek words, right? Proto means first, right? Euangelion is Greek word for good news, evangelism, the good news, and they smash those together, right? Proto-evangelium. But really what that is the first gospel. The first gospel that's mentioned is Genesis 3:15. And we see that gospel, it's that, again, your offspring, there will be this battle, enmity, battle, right, between the serpent's offspring and humanity. There will be this battle, but then at one point in time, Eve, your offspring, will bruise the head of the serpent, right? And the serpent will bruise the heel. So both parties will be injured, so to speak, but when you bruise the head, you kill, right? You destroy. And so there will be one to come that will destroy, but oh, by the way, it will be a little pain on the way out. But in the end, Eve, your offspring, will destroy. Then we get into chapter 4, Cain and Abel, right? I mentioned this already, so I'll kind of move quickly through that. But first murder in history. First murder, and I talked about that. Cain was angry that God didn't accept his offering like he did for Abel's. He's angry. He says, sin is crouching at your door. The desire is contrary to you. It's among you. It's right there. That desire to sin is right at your door. Don't do it. Rule over it. Fight against that sin. Cain doesn't do it. Kills his brother. Kills it. Whoa, whoa. Hey. It's not what I ordered you to do. It's rebellion. Rebellion. I didn't do that on purpose, but this is divine rebellion. Apple. And then we get this little, it's a few verses, but it's big, right? Lamech, he comes in here and he's boasting, right? He's a descendant of Cain. And he said, look, you think my great-great-great-great-grandfather was bad. Man, I'm a bad man. I'm marrying multiple women. I'm killing people for even just looking at me wrong. I'm killing them. I'm bad. You think Cain was bad? Sevenfold is the revenge? 77-fold. That's how bad I am. And so just this wickedness continues to happen, and it's spreading. It goes from individual to worldwide now, we're talking. And Adam and Eve look at this and say, yeah, well, we got to do something different, right? And so they give birth to Seth, and they start the line goes through Seth. And of course, through chapter 6 and 9, we get the flood. God calls Noah. What's interesting about Noah is Noah has something going for him from what God gives us, right? He says he's righteous. He's blameless. He walks with God. So if we look at it from a humanly standpoint, it makes sense. Okay, God's going to use him. He's the one that's righteous amongst everybody. God's going to use him. He has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And those are the ones that will, again, the line will continue to spread through them. And God gives a covenant. Once he gets everybody on the boat, the animals come two by two, he floods the earth. He blots out everything, and he's starting over with Noah and his family. But guess what? When you blot out the earth, the heart doesn't change. Sin is still there. It just needs time to spread once again. And so, of course, it happens. Noah gets drunk, and Ham walks in on sees his father naked, and Noah bestows a curse upon Canaan, which is the descendant of Ham. And the interesting part, again, is you read these genealogies. I know sometimes, like, oh, here's another genealogy. But read through it and even pick up on the names. Cush, Egypt, Canaan, Babel, Sodom, Gomorrah. All of these are enemies of Israel, right? Enemies of the nation. And these are descendants. These are people's names that are descending from Ham. Get through 10 to 12. Babel and the nations, again, God gives them a plan. Go fill the earth. Be fruitful. Multiply. They say, no, I got a better idea. Let us make a name for ourselves. Let us do that. Let's build something. God goes right down, and he shakes things up, right? And he says, I'm going to get my way. I'm going to shake up, give you all different languages, and then I'll spread you out since you don't want to do it. OK, Okay, so God puts his plan into place, and therefore they're spread out, dispersed, and languages come up through that, right? Languages that they can't understand. It was one language, and now they can't understand one another, so they go about all of the earth. Now, as I mentioned, I want to talk about this covenant, because this is huge, again, and this is a thing you have to spend time on. This is so critically important, a game changer for the book of Genesis. It happens in starting in chapter 12. And that is Genesis 1 through 3. It says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, and your name will be great, so that you will be a blessing. You'll be a blessing to everybody else because of the blessing I'm going to do to you. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So through this one man, everybody is going to be blessed. You might say, okay, got it. But what's different between him and Noah, from a human standpoint, there's no reason he should have chose Abraham. Zero. Abraham wasn't bringing anything. He wasn't righteous. He wasn't somebody that was following the Lord. Matter of fact, Joshua tells us, it says, and Joshua tells all the people, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, long ago your fathers beyond Euphrates, Terah, Abraham's father, and Nahor, they served other gods." They were serving other gods. But God says, I'm going to use this man that's serving other gods. He wasn't righteous. So from our standpoint, there's no reason Abraham should be chosen. But God says, I'm going to use you. I'm going to bless people through you. You're not bringing anything to the table. I'm the one choosing you, and I'm going to use you. Sound like a familiar story? Right? Election, right? He's not bringing anybody. God could have chosen any family, any nation, any location. He could have chose Babylon to be his people. Sounds crazy, but if he would have started with Babylon, he could have chose Babylon. He could have chose Nebuchadnezzar to be his vessel that he used. It would have been perfectly fine. The story would have continued. No reason to choose Abraham. So we often look at Abraham and see the post-work and say, wow, Abraham is a man of faith. He shouldn't have been chosen. According to us, doesn't make sense to us, right? But God used divine election for his plan. God says, here's a vessel that is wicked. I get it, but I'm going to use him for my glory. And he's going to be a blessing to all humanity. So again, chapter 12, verses 1 through 3 are huge. He's going to bless Abraham, which then the blessing spread to you and I today. Because of the holiness of Israel, and then because God is now saying, Israel, this covenant that I have with them, I'm now spreading it across the earth, you and I can be saved. But it starts with Abraham. So think about that. Think about how that constant reflection of Abraham, that covenant that he gave. No reason at all he should have chose him, but he did. Patriarchal history. So we'll get through this 12 through 50. But here again is what I want you to take a look at the map. These first two specifically. And so you see Ur right here. This is where Abraham starts, right? Abraham starts here, and then his family, by the time we're having conversations, are up in Haran. And Haran is where he constantly goes back to find a wife. He sends his son to find a wife. Go back to Haran, where my people. I don't want you to get one of these Canaanites. They're wicked. Go back to Haran, where my family is. Get people there, right? And then he makes his way down, and you see all these arrows here. It just means they were always on the move, right? They never settled. They were sojourners. You hear that word a lot? They were always on the move for whatever reason, to get better land, get better water supply, whatever it was. And so Abraham goes all the way here. He makes his way into Egypt. Remember, he lies to Pharaoh. So he comes all the way down here, lies to Pharaoh. Then he backpedals here, and then he's going to go over here and help Lot out because Lot's getting in trouble over here, which is, again, on your second sheet. Lot goes to Sodom and Gomorrah. When they split, he's in Sodom and Gomorrah. Zoar, you'll hear this. Zoar, see how close it is to this region of Sodom and Gomorrah? God says when Lot stepped foot in Zoar, right, he just crossed the county line, going from Orange County to L.A., he burned the place down because he promised. He promised him. Abraham prayed for him and said, spare anybody that's righteous there. God said, okay, anybody that's righteous, one family. I'm tearing the other place down. So as soon as he crosses the county line, he tears the place down. But you see how close that is. Zoar, when you hear that, it's like, man, he was right on the edges, and then he burned it down. And, of course, Lot's wife, still close enough to look back, turns into a little salt, right? But the proximity of it is important as we read through all of these. So think about that as we go through it. And I'll highlight it to as best as I can as we walk through. So again, we talk about chapters 12 through 23. Again, it should be a review for you, but Abraham lies about Sarah, right? Sarai right now, Abram and Sarai, but I'll just refer to him as Abraham and Sarah. He lies about her. He goes to Pharaoh. He gets down there and Pharaoh sees Sarah and she's attractive. He says, "It's my sister," because he's trying to protect himself, right? God steps in and helps. And then Abraham and Lot get together and Pharaoh's giving them all the flocks. He's giving them all these blessings. And so they got so much going on, they can't even live together. And so they split off. Right, Lot goes his separate way. He pushes up towards Sodom and Gomorrah area, and Abraham hangs out in Canaan area, and they're there, right? Until things start to shake up and things start to happen. Lot gets in trouble. Abraham has to go save him. Remember, the kings got together and they captured Lot. And it says Abraham went all the way up, followed that red line to Hobah. So he's chasing them from Kadesh area all the way to Hobah to get Lot back. That's a long way to go to track them down, but he does. He tracks them down, and of course, he gets Lot back. And once he gets Lot back, then we know the story there with Sodom and Gomorrah. Again, you have the angels that are there. You have the men of Sodom come to the door, and they want to sexually assault the men, right? We see some homosexuality there. They want to sexually assault the men, and they're blinded. They're blinded, and then God makes that decision of, I've had enough. This place is going away, right? Sodom and Gomorrah. So we see that with Abram and Lot. He gets rescued. Sarah and Hagar, I mentioned that earlier, is we get the situation where she's getting frustrated. She wants kids. We're getting all these promises about kids. Why can't I have kids? Sarah gives Hagar over to Abraham to have offspring. Has Ishmael, and she hates it right away. Kicks her out of the house, wants nothing to do with her, but God's going to protect Ishmael and Hagar as well. And then Abraham gets the covenant sign. So he officially gets his name changed in chapter 17, but then God gives him the covenant sign of, if you're going to be my people, you're going to be circumcised. This is going to be part of you being set apart from everybody else. So on the eighth day, you're going to circumcise all of the men. Unfortunately, the men were older than 8 years or after 8 days, so it hurt a little bit. Okay, so all the men got circumcised, and now moving forward, 8 days, you get circumcised. Promise to about Isaac. Remember in 17, 18, they both laughed. They both did. All right, we talk about Sarah laughing, but Isaac chuckled too when he's like, oh, dude, I'm about to be 100. Right? Sarah's about to be 90. What do you want us to do? Why won't you have a baby and take care of this baby? I know you're old. I know you're wrinkled. I know you're going to have a hard time playing baseball with the kid out back, but have this baby. Right, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to protect you. And he gives them the child, right? What he promised them from the beginning. I double click that. But Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed, as I mentioned. As soon as he got in Zoar, God wiped the place out. As soon as he got out, Abraham lies again in Gerar. So take a look at Gerar, because we'll hear that word again. And so that is in that white square. I didn't mention this is Canaan. So this is the whole area of Canaan and all the cities in between. So Gerar is within the region of Canaan. And so he lies to Abimelech because he, again, fears for his life. He didn't think that they're godly people or righteous people, so he lies. And then, of course, in 21 through 22, Isaac's birth and their sacrifice. Isaac finally has his son. Praise God, we got the son that God had promised. I'm 100 years old and old now. And then God says, go kill him. What? You just gave me the son. Yeah, I know. Go kill him. Sacrifice him. Take him. And so Abraham did, right? And this was his statement of faith. Like, God knew at that point, because after this, God says, I will surely bless you because I know you're willing to give up your one and only son that I promised you that you waited for because I've commanded you to do that. So you're obedient. And of course, he didn't have to sacrifice him. I just one day want to hear that conversation. What did Sarah have to say? Because he had to go back and tell her, like, you want to know what I did today? I almost killed Isaac. You did what? You almost killed Isaac? I just want to know how that conversation went. So there was probably some counseling in there after that. Had to be. You just don't get away with that. Anyway, then we get the death of Sarah. And again, what is significant about this is they're in Canaan. They're foreigners here, not supposed to be there. And he's able to buy land and get her buried in Canaan. And so that sets the stage again for the takeover of God giving this land to Abraham and his descendants, because they're already burying their family here. And so they're setting up shop here already. Of course, they didn't know any of that, but that's significant that she's buried there first, and then we see multiple people throughout the line continue to get buried there. All right, then we get into Isaac. Isaac has this short stint. I mean, Isaac is a significant part, right? He's one of the patriarchs, but he's dominated by Abraham and then Jacob. So he kind of gets squeezed in here with only a couple verses or chapters that really talk about him. But the first one is he's sent up again, all the way back up to Haran to get a wife there. You can't have a Canaanite, so he goes and he gets a wife from Laban, or the brother of Rebecca, Laban and his family. And they say this line in Genesis 24:60, and they as they're sending Rebecca off, they say, "Your offspring will possess the gate of those who hate him." He'll possess the gate of the evil ones, the ones that hate him. So when you talk about him, they're talking about Christ there, right? And so as they're sending her off, they're saying, wow, you're going to be part of this line. They don't know, but God is telling him that somebody from your line is going to possess the gates of those who hate him. Jesus foreshadowing there. And then Abraham, again, is buried with Sarah, buried with her in the land of Canaan. Significant that they set up shop there before they actually have the land. And then we get the story of Jacob and Esau. Again, this starts to dominate the story, but of course, as you know, she's having twins, and it's like they're warring within her, right? And so she gets Jacob and Esau out, and Jacob is a deceiver, and he drives his brother crazy, right? Because his brother's hungry, and he tricks him into giving him his birthright. Right, the dad is ready to give the older child the blessing, and Rebecca's even a part of this too. She's the one that hears it. She's the one that sets up the meal and says, "Here, go execute this plan." So she's no saint either, but she sets all of this up. And again, he's deceived. Jacob gets the blessing, but bad choice. But all part of God's plan that's there. And then we get Isaac lying about Rebecca and Gerar. Same thing, Abimelech. Same place. Same throne, he lies and wants to protect himself. So then if you turn your attention to this other map that we have here, this talks most about Jacob's time and where he's traveling from. So as he's that red arrow that's coming out from up there, as he's coming out of this region from Haran, he's coming back, right? He's coming back, and Laban is not happy. Laban feels he got tricked, he got deceived in the end, although he gave Jacob a taste of his own medicine. He's coming back, and he's chasing him down. And then, oh, by the way, he's chasing him down, and he interacts with Esau as well. Esau's still not happy. Well, at least Jacob thinks that, and so Esau is part of this picture too. So we have Jacob, Rachel, Leah, and Laban as they leave Haran. And remember, Rachel is who he wanted. Leah is who he got. Ended up staying there for a lot longer than he thought, because he was blessing the land. God was blessing him, and Laban's like, wait, you're being a blessing to us. Like, stay here for a little bit, right? After you served for Leah, you served for Rachel, stay here for a little bit and continue to allow God to bless us because of your presence being here. But Jacob had enough of that, and he wanted to get out. So he gets out. He returns home in chapters 31 through 35. As he returns home, he has this wrestling match with the angel of the Lord, gets his hip socket taken out of place. So now he has this limp, but he demands to be blessed, right? And this is where he gets his name changed from Jacob to Israel, and he is reminded that he will be a blessing and he will be protected. Well, you know, Esau, he gets word that, hey, I'm crossing Esau's land. I'm still fearful for what I did to Esau. He's going to come after me. So he starts to send all these gifts ahead to Esau. Esau's coming to see you. So he's like, hey, go tell Esau he can have all of these flocks. Go tell Esau this. Go tell Esau. And I'm going to stay. I want Rachel to stay back here because I want to protect her, because I don't know what Esau is going to do. Well, Esau, of course, gives him a big hug. He weeps. He's happy to see him. And they have a great reunion, great time. One other thing that happens is, I alluded to this earlier, is the Dinah's revenge, right? And what they get into Canaan, and Shechem there, he likes Dinah, and he rapes her, but then he falls in love with her, and he wants to marry her. And so they're like, hey, like, give us your sister. We want everything to be good now. I know I raped her, but we want everything to be good. Okay, cool. You want everything to be good, then circumcise everybody. Like, go along with what we're doing. Circumcise everybody. And, of course, they do. And Dinah's brothers get revenge, right? And they wipe out the entire nation. And so this is a threat to the blessing, because now the whole region of Canaan can power up and seek revenge on this little family here and then cancel out all of God's blessings that he has. But God doesn't allow that to happen. He brings terror, is what the word says. He brings terror to their mind of even thinking about going after them, so they leave them alone. But Jacob is not happy about it. This one I'll blaze through pretty quickly, just because you can see it once we send this out. But basically, this is the line. This is where everybody's coming from. And as you see, Jacob, along with Rachel and Leah, they have all of their children, the tribes of Jacob. And from that, you even see Joseph's descendants as well, Manasseh and Ephraim, which we'll hear about in the end. Now where we are today, getting into where we are today, Joseph, again, verse 37, he's telling his brothers that he's going to reign over them, and they don't like it. They devise a plan to at first want to kill him, but then let's just sell him into slavery. Just get him out of here. And so they do that. But then we get also what we read today, which is weird. Talking about Tamar and Judah, it almost seems like it comes out of left field, but it makes perfect sense that it happens, right? So Tamar is married to Ur, who is Judah's son, and Ur gets killed. The second born ends up getting killed. He doesn't want to sleep with her. He's like, I want my own offspring. I don't want to live with, or sleep with my brother's sister or brother's wife. So he ends up getting killed. And then Judah is like, I want to protect my son, my last son. So, you know, just go hang out, be a widow, Tamar, and then I'll get back to you. Well, he doesn't. And Tamar wants something. She wants the son. And so she goes out and acts as a prostitute, and Judah's wickedness, he takes her, and she gives him a sick, she asks for his, basically payment, and he says, I'll give you a goat, right? I can't give it to you now, but give me something to hold over just for this time. And so he gives her this signet ring and this cord that he promises, hold on to that, and I'll bring you the goat back in exchange for me sleeping with you, and then I'll get back to you. So she takes that, and then she leaves. And then they find out that she's pregnant, and he's furious. He's furious. He's like, how could she be pregnant? I told her to go stay in the house. She's a widow, and I would get back to her, and now she's sleeping around. Well, he says, let her be burned. She should be burned because she didn't listen to what I said. And she says, whose stuff is this? And he goes, oh, wow, you're more righteous than I am, right? And so it's weird, and it doesn't flow with the story, but the reason that it has to happen is because Perez, right? Perez is who is born from that. And if you see that, Perez is, his descendant is Boaz. And we work our way down, this becomes the line that Jesus is born from, right? The line of David, right? And so God uses this situation to where Tamar and Judah have a baby, which they shouldn't in our eyes, but he even uses that wickedness to say, I'm going to take Perez, and he's going to be part of this line that I'm going to create that's going to eventually get down to Jesus. All right. 4 more minutes to get through all the rest of this. So Joseph in Egypt, again, I'll kind of get through this quickly, overview. He's sold into Egypt and automatically sold into Potiphar's court, who was an officer, right? And he works his way up to the top. Potiphar's wife tries to sleep with him. She devises a scheme to grab some of the rope and say, he tried to rape me. I didn't do anything. So he gets put in prison. Once he gets put in prison, of course, then he has the cupbearer there and he has the baker that's there. And they're having these wicked dreams. And Joseph says, well, let me hear your dreams. And, of course, the cupbearer says, I have this dream. And he says, you will be blessed in 3 days. And his blessing is he's taken out of prison and he's put back into his job as cupbearer for Pharaoh. And the baker says, hey, I want some of that too. I got a dream. What about my dream? You'll die in 3 days. What? Okay, so, and he does, right? He dies in 3 days, he gives him, and it all comes to truth. And so he tells the cupbearer, remember me, right? Remember me when you get out, like help me out here. And he doesn't remember him until Pharaoh has a dream and nobody can interpret it. And then cupbearer's like, well, there was this one guy, right? He can interpret. Okay, bring him to me, right? So Joseph gets an opportunity to interpret this dream for Pharaoh, which he tells him about these seven cows, and some are ugly, some are plump, and he's talking about the famine to come. So you're going to have these 7 years where you're going to have plenty of grain, you're going to have plenty of food there, and then you're going to have 7 years of famine. So basically store up. And you know, Pharaoh's impressed, and he's like, I like this guy. He says, you should put somebody in charge. Okay, you should be in charge. And so he becomes Pharaoh's right-hand man, second guy, Pharaoh calls him, up under him over all of Egypt. Well, then, of course, when that famine comes, they come to Egypt, and they're like, hey, we need to get food. And Joseph immediately knows who his brothers are, but they don't know who he is. So he plays with them a little bit, right? He knows about the situation, so he asks questions that they're going to answer. Oh, you know, we had another brother, but he died. Oh, really? You did? That's cool. You know, how did he die? I'm just curious. I wouldn't know, right? But he knows the entire time, and so he sends back because he wants them to go bring Benjamin. That would be tough. Go bring me Benjamin. Otherwise, I'm going to make it hard for you. And they can't do that as far as they can't risk that. So they go back and they plead with their father to get Benjamin. They come back. Joseph continues to kind of, you know, I guess push on them a little bit and make them work for this. And eventually he lets them know who he is and says that, you know what, I've been promoted up. You wanted to do these things for bad reasons. God had it for good. And so he, again, rises to number two. God uses all of the wickedness and all of the bad things that are happening, and still his plan is not thwarted. And Joseph reunites with his brothers. Of course, Jacob gets the opportunity to see Joseph again, which he is thrilled with, and then he gives blessings to his brothers, blessings to everyone in the house that's there in the family as well. So two verses that I want to key in on towards the end, to make sure that you get, because again, this sets the stage for everything moving forward, is Jacob's blessing to Judah. It says Judah is a lion's club, right? So we say that tribe of Judah, right? Lion. From prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and a lioness. Who dares rouse him? Right? And then he says this in verse 10. He says, the scepter, right, shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff. So he's saying the kingdom, right? These kingly things, the scepter, that's what kings hold, should not depart from him, from between his feet, until the tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of all people. Him. Who is that him? Jesus, right? He's talking about Jesus to come. They don't know everything, but to him, Jesus is going to come from the line of Judah, right? And so this is talked about in Genesis. It's the promise that has never been changed, right? And then the last verse that we're all familiar with is, look, they apologize once Jacob's gone. They're like, oh, man, he's going to kill us now. Like, we got to apologize. And Joseph says, look, do not fear, for I'm not in the place of God. Like, who am I? Right? God's done everything here. He says, that's for you. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. God meant it for good to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Okay, quickly. Key takeaways that I want you to take away from the book of Genesis as we think about studying it and even hearing it today. You need to daily check and make sure you're not trying to be God in your life. Right, you're not trying to be God in your life. And I say that because it happens all too often. We want things our way, right? This should have happened for me. I deserve this. This is the way things should go. And it's just natural for us to do that, right? We want things for ourselves, but we need to daily check and make sure, am I glorifying God with all that I'm doing? Am I making sure that I'm not being bad as everybody that we read about in Genesis when they say, you know, did God really say, or let me make a name for myself. Let me get a little bit of glory here, God. I'll give you 98% of it. Let me get 2%. No, God wants 100%. So daily make sure you're not trying to be God in your life and make choices. Sin and evil, again, has everything to do with us, not God. Everything to do with us, not God. God's not involved. God can't sin. Like all of these bad things that happen, if you just backtrack, you'll realize that it's because of humanity. It's because of us. And the last thing is have absolute confidence in God's plan for redemption. Absolute confidence. It's the same plan that's been in place since that regeneration time. This is what God had, and this is what's going to happen. This is a redemptive plan for man, and there's nothing that this culture, that this world can do to thwart it. At the end of the day, no matter what the culture says, every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess, right, that Jesus is Lord. It's going to happen. It's already set, and God gives us that for a reason, and he gives us these promises, and he lets us see that through all this wickedness, it's still going to happen. And so be confident in God's plan for redemption regardless of what the world has to say. One thing about soccer is that referee, he holds a lot of power within soccer. And if you're familiar with soccer, at the end of the game in soccer, they have this area called stoppage time. Stoppage time is like every time that the game was stopped for injury, for whatever it was, the clock keeps going, but the referee keeps a clock of how much time was left that was not played, and he adds it on to the end. Well, the thing about stoppage time is the players, the coaches, have no idea when the game is going to end, really. They can guess. They can have an idea, but they just keep playing, and at any point in time, the referee can call the game and say, stoppage time is over, game's over. So if you're down by 1 point, it's time to hustle because we got to tie this thing up because I don't know when it's going to end. Well, what I want you to think about as we leave here today is God is the referee of this life. And we're in stoppage time right now, Christians. And at any point in time, God's going to call this game. And he's going to call it the way he wants to call it, and he's going to call it the way that he's victorious in the end. And so understand that this, nobody knows when it's going to end. God's going to call the game soon. And just make sure within your life that when God calls this game, the stoppage time, that he can look at you and say, well done, good and faithful servant. Let's pray. God, we do thank you for the book of Genesis. We thank you that it sets up the entire Bible story, Lord. And I just pray that through this year, we would have a better understanding than we've had in the past, that we would understand everything that you have set for your redemptive plan. And that is going to happen. Lord, regardless of what the world may tell us, nothing can thwart your plan, and I pray that this will give us confidence to see it. Bad choices after bad choices after bad choices, but your plan and your promise remains the same, and we thank you for that faithfulness to us because we don't deserve it, Lord. And Lord, I just pray that this would be fruitful, that as we finish up Genesis, that this would be, again, the year that we've understood and taken more out of Genesis than we ever have in the past, Lord, and I pray that you would be honored by it. In Jesus' name, amen. Yeah.